NPR News Station.
This is 88.1 WYPR, Baltimore's NPR News Station. Community Amplified.
Oil prices surging, gas prices already rising here in the U.S., and President Trump has said the Iran ceasefire is over.
Gas prices are up. What does that mean for the city and the state? I'm News Director Matt Bush, and this is WYPR's News Roundup. Today, transportation, what the war in Iran means for gas prices at home. We tackle a tunnel vision project with, well, tunnel vision. And Baltimore's Red Line reemerges in a new film.
Nowhere ever have I experienced the vicious, ignorant, and racist hatred of public transit that I have observed here.
Later in the show, the showdown between the governor and a local paper. And then we talk about some real American theater, just a quick road trip away. That's all next. First, the news.
Live from NPR News, I'm Lakshmi Singh. Homeland Security Secretary Mark Wayne Mullen's warning state officials that if they do not implement the Trump administration's election security measures, they could face penalties. NPR's Jude Jaffe Block reports his remarks follow the president's speech last night.
Mullen says DHS will roll out an updated election infrastructure plan for states, and they will lose access to grants if they don't follow it. The Trump administration wants states to use a federal data system known as SAVE to check voter rolls for non-citizens and deceased voters. Mullen had a warning for state officials that don't participate.
We will make sure that we make those states a priority to look at who voted in their states and hold then the election officials accountable.
That could mean fines or even prison time, Mullen said. He says DHS found 250,000 non-citizens on the public voter rolls of four states, but how DHS arrived at that number is unknown, and election experts say that figure is likely highly inaccurate. Jude Jaffe Block, NPR News.
China has launched a new multilateral organization on artificial intelligence. And Chinese leader Xi Jinping says countries need to collaborate to improve AI governance worldwide. More from NPR's John Ruich.
Speaking at the start of the World AI Conference in Shanghai, Xi Jinping did not mention the U.S. by name, but made some targeted comments. He said AI development should not be a solo performance by a single country. Rather, he said it should be a symphony of global collaboration. While the U.S. has pulled back from multilateral organizations under the Trump administration, China has stepped up. And on Friday, it launched the World AI Cooperation Organization with the participation of nearly 30 other countries, including Brazil, Indonesia and Russia. Xi pledged support from China for AI development in the developing world through training and other programs, and urged the creation of laws as well as monitoring and warning systems around AI to keep it safe. John Ruich, NPR News.
Millions of people from the Midwest and Mid-Atlantic woke up to a blanket of wildfire smoke from Canada and northern Minnesota. Here's New York resident Barbara Glickstein.
I'm healthy, but I know what air particles do to the body, and I wish more people were wearing masks and little babies and children were inside.
NPR's Kristen Wright with more.
The air quality is expected to get worse throughout the day in D.C., where you can smell the smoke at times. Detroit, Chicago, and New York are experiencing some of the worst air quality in the world, according to rankings by IQ Air. And meteorologists say it's among the worst in years. Parts of Pennsylvania hit code purple, which is worse than red. Smoke from more than 800 wildfires burning in Canada is able to travel long distances, and the summer heat can make the air quality even worse. Officials are advising people to stay indoors, especially older adults, children, and those with health issues. Kristen Wright, NPR News, Washington.
It's NPR. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention says lettuce from Mexico served at Taco Bell sites in five states is a source of the widespread outbreak of the diarrhea-causing parasite Cyclospora. The Associated Press cites a federal official saying the lettuce came from a single supplier in Mexico. NPR has not independently confirmed that, and Taylor Farms, which is based in California, has not responded to a request for comment. Dozens of former Dollar General workers and supporters protested in New Orleans earlier this week, angry over how the company handled a wave of store closures. The Gulf States Newsroom's Tanner O'Neill Riley has the latest.
Dollar General has closed all but one of its New Orleans stores in the past couple of years. Former employees say they got little warning. Some say they learned they were out of a job only when they tried to clock in. Organizers of the protest say workers were paid only through the week of the closures with no severance pay and no guaranteed transfer to another store. They're calling on Dollar General to offer 60 days of severance, transfers to other stores, and advance notice for future closures. In a statement, Dollar General said the employees were paid for scheduled time and invited to apply for jobs at other store locations. For NPR News, I'm Tanner O'Neill Riley in New Orleans.
Parts of Puerto Rico are rationing water in the wake of a drought in the U.S. territory. The Associated Press cited the head of the island's Water and Sewer Authority saying thousands of people in northeastern Puerto Rico faced 48-hour rationing periods starting today. I'm Lakshmi Singh, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Progressive Insurance, now hiring for virtual and hybrid employment, offering opportunities for professional development and career progression. Position details can be found at careers.progressive.com.
As the dog days of summer settle over Charm City, shake them off at WTMD's next First Thursday concert. With the cool rhythm and blues of Sun Little, acoustic folk pop by New York's Late Night Thoughts, and Rise Above It All with Baltimore's Icarus Phoenix. Find all you need in the Vendor Village. Local food, drink, even art. Maryland's best outdoor concert experience is free. WTMD's First Thursday, August 6th in Canton Waterfront Park. Details at WTMD.org.
And good afternoon and welcome to the WYPR News Roundup, our weekly look at some of the big issues facing the Baltimore region and Maryland. I'm Matt Bush, news director of the award-winning WYPR Newsroom. This week, we focus on transportation. With temperatures above 100 degrees, a higher heat index, and smoke coming from Canadian wildfires, giving us a fantastic combination of hot, sweaty, and smoky, it may seem like a good time to get out of town. But then there's gas prices. U.S. President Donald Trump's war on Iran has cost American families close to $500 at the pump this year. That's according to the Center for American Progress. In Baltimore, gas prices rose 17 cents a gallon this week with renewed U.S. strikes on bridges and infrastructure in Iran. We'll have Melody Simmons with the Baltimore Business Journal on to talk about that shortly. Then we'll take a look at the history of two transportation projects, one that began and ended this spring, a plan to bore a tunnel to M&T Bank Stadium, home of the Ravens. That project may have had tunnel vision indeed. We'll find out what Elon Musk had to do with it. Then an update on and a look back on Baltimore's plagued red line. The plan to traverse the city by bus or rail has yet to see the light of day. A new film explores the checkered history and what it says about Baltimore and Maryland. We'll have a chat with the director. Later in the show, a national news outlet revealed what could be a new stage in the ongoing issues between two Baltimore conservative media outlets and the Maryland governor. We'll have more on that for you from a Semaphore's media reporter who broke the story. And finally, some real drama in its literal sense. For those of you who can manage to make it out of the city, the Contemporary American Theater Festival, an hour and a half away in Shepherdstown, West Virginia, promises shows you've never seen. We'll tell you about some of them. But first, gas prices. We have Melody Simmons with the Baltimore Business Journal here in studio to talk with us about how they got where they are and how long they're going to stay there and how to strategize to get the best bang for your buck. Melody, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Matt. Well, thanks for having me.
So let's start by talking about these prices. I know a lot of us hear about a war in the Middle East. We know gas comes from the Middle East, and so it makes sense that gas prices are rising. But unfortunately, it's not that simple an explanation, correct?
That's right. It's pain at the pump. That is what everybody's feeling and everybody's talking about. So people are keeping their eyes on the headlines, but they're also keeping their eyes on their pocketbook. So we've got quite a summer ahead of us.
Now, Baltimore prices rose 17 cents this week, 80 cents for the year. That's overall in the state of Maryland. If it rises another 20 or so cents this next week, that starts to add up. And for many, it's already adding up. If this is where we're headed, is there any way to buffer this? What sorts of things can people do to help ease the pain?
Well, there's a lot that's going on. It's multi-layered. A lot of people are cutting back on their trips, or they're merging. If I have to go to the grocery store, I'm going to go and pick up the dry cleaning at the same time. So they're merging trips. There's also a lot of discussion and a lot of practice to try to use bonus points that you can get on your grocery card to try to take off some money at the pump. Friend told me that yesterday that she got 50 cents off per gallon by using her giant points. So things like this, there are certain trapdoors that you can still use that will help.
I use some of those myself. Unfortunately, it does mean spending more money at those other stores to bring those points
where
up.
Where the prices are also high.
Right, exactly. So there is a trade-off there. Now, not all of this is because of the U.S. war in Iran. Back in my earlier days as a State House reporter, I covered the big increase to Maryland's gas tax.
The bill calls for the tax to rise annually with the rate of inflation, and that drew the ire of Republicans like Kathy Zaliga of Baltimore and Harford counties, who called this increase a first for the state.
This would be the eternal tax that will go up every year.
As you can tell from my voice, that was 13 years ago. And this month, a small part of the gas tax increase in Maryland was because of that bill. There's annual discussions in getting rid of the indexing, and it's probably going to come up again next month's special session of the General Assembly, which is on congressional redistricting. Is this something we're going to be living with? Is this ever going to change the indexing, you think?
Well, I'm not sure it's going to change. The state is reliant on that revenue. And, of course, the state's revenues are very stretched in the red. So I think it's a little too optimistic to think that they're going to cut back on that. Of course, the gas tax here is among the highest in America, and it's 46.6 cents per gallon. And then when you add the 18-cent federal tax on top of that, it really adds up.
Now, how does this lack of income affect the state budget? You just mentioned, obviously, this was something in this year's budget, but it is going forward, and there's an even bigger budget shortfall projected for next year. So just to go through that very quickly, what does that mean, that this income from something like a gas tax, how that ends up translating to the state budget?
Well, they have projections, revenue projections, that goes into the budgeting and into the revenue estimates. And so because of that, they're able to estimate, based on past usage and prices, how much they are going to receive and how much money they have to play with. So that's what they're dealing with. It's always an estimate, but yet it's counted on as revenue.
You mentioned earlier apps that people can use their bonus cards and advantage cards at certain stores, particularly grocery stores, but there's other ones, gas stations. Some of the larger chains have their own apps that, again, as much as you spend money, you get you can get points off. You get add up for points that then give you a percentage or, you know, cents off of the gallon. What else can people do other than use those or just not drive?
Well, you see a lot of people talking. I think people are starting to swap and compare notes. And I know it's a discussion in my neighborhood in Baltimore as to, you know, where you're finding some good gas prices, mm-hmm. where you can go. So it's starting at a grassroots level. People are starting to really talk about it and help each other. I do think also that vacations have cut back. You see a lot of travel, mm-hmm. and you really are seeing people very aware of it. It's on the radar screen. It's a personal choice now, based on how much it's costing you to fill up that tank. I was looking yesterday; it's about $3.99 a gallon. Mm-hmm. I was out near a Costco, and my thought was, "Let me go top off my tank." I got over to Costco. It looked like the end of the world, like the apocalypse was coming, and not from the smoke, but right. Basically there were so many cars lined up to get that gas and the cheaper gas. So this is what we're seeing now. It's like a giant Monopoly game.
How does something like this affect the city and the region as well? This week, our news partners, the Baltimore Banner, had a story on development slowing in the region. Are gas prices related to the slowing in the region? This is something you guys look at, too.
Yeah, we look at that a lot, and we are very well aware of certain projects that are kind of tied to the supply chain. And, of course, the supply chain is impacted by the cost of gas and fuel. So this is one thing that we're seeing, and when people are trying to stack funding mm-hmm. for certain projects, they have to add that in. That is still a variable. It's an X factor right now, but we do know that it is higher based on the percentage that we're seeing in the price index. So yes, it is having an impact. A lot of the projects in the works that haven't launched yet are actually in a waiting game, in a holding game. And that's part of the stack to figure out how to make it go.
Well, are there particular projects, are there projects in particular that are being impacted by this? We know there's some areas like the Inner Harbor that are due for some massive redevelopment. Are things like that going to get impacted? There are specific projects maybe that are being impacted by it more than others.
There's a lot of projects going on. There is an anticipation that they will kick off the State Center project over on the west side, and also downtown, the Superblock. So these are two huge projects that are in the works for Baltimore. They're pretty much in the real early stages on the drawing board. They may wait it out with the war. We're not sure how long this war is going to go on. There's a story in the Wall Street Journal today that basically says the pain is going to continue because the refineries can't boot up fast enough to produce the fuel that we need, even if the straits reopen.
And with the uncertainty that goes on there, we seem to learn something new every day about whether or not it's going to be open or not anytime soon. So that, and as you said, the refineries need their time to pick back up. So it's all a waiting game, unfortunately, for all of us. But again, Baltimore being in its geographic place in between D.C. and Philadelphia and New York and some larger cities up and down there, are we impacted more by higher gas prices compared to some of those larger cities?
I think we are, because Baltimore's trying to reset right now. And it's very important to the people, the stakeholders, and the leaders here, that this city start moving forward a little quicker than it has. You've got the vacancy problems downtown. You've got the Harbor Place, as you mentioned, project kind of poised to kick off. You know, the bottom line matters in all of that. So for Baltimore, it could be a higher stake because they have such high ambitions right now. And the fuel costs and the energy costs are a giant part of that.
Melody Simmons is with the Baltimore Business Journal. You have some big things coming up. You want to give us a preview of what you guys are going to be reporting on very, very soon?
Well, we are busy this summer working on a series on Baltimore itself and looking at what Baltimore could be if it in a perfect world. And so our staff is right now out there reporting and gathering string and stories on that. And it's very interesting what we're finding. As you know, this is a city that has great history and great energy, but also is always trying really hard to bring itself up geographically to some of its neighbors.
Melody Simmons again with the Baltimore Business Journal. Check out their work and get ready for that work coming out next month. Thank you so much for coming into the studio today.
Thanks for having me.
Coming up next, we're going to talk to Danny Zawadi with our news partners at the Baltimore Banner about what it could have been a boring tunnel through downtown Baltimore funded by the richest man in the world, but was then abruptly canceled. That's after the break. It's not a boring story. Trust us. I'm Matt Bush, and this is WIPR's News Roundup. Stay with us.
LGBTQ plus people have long been part of Maryland's story, but their histories have often gone untold. In the latest episode of Maryland Unfolded, Dr. Kalima Young speaks with Ben Eagerman about the state's LGBTQ plus past and his new book, A Gay Little History of Maryland. Maryland Unfolded is available on the first and third Thursdays of the month at WYPR.org or wherever you get your podcasts, and is made possible in part by Gallagher LLP.
Many people in the community make WIPR possible. Monthly sustaining members, annual donors, and support from local businesses and foundations fuel our work. Another meaningful way to build a lasting future for public media in Maryland is to include WIPR in your will or estate plan. For more information, please visit WIPR.org/legacy.
Before the U.S.-Iran war, about one-fifth of the world's oil passed freely through the Strait of Hormuz. Now Iran controls the strait. What precedent does that set for other waterways? That's on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Don't miss All Things Considered this afternoon at 4 here on WIPR, where support comes from Ann Hoke Attorneys, representing people who are seriously injured in motor vehicle or work accidents. More information is available at hurtcallhoke.com. This is WIPR at 88.1.
And welcome back. You're listening to WIPR's News Roundup, our weekly show examining some of the big issues facing Baltimore, the state, and the region. Today we're tackling transportation. And we're going to talk about a potentially boring tunnel project in downtown Baltimore that was not boring at all. The tunnel that wasn't is how Danny Zawadny describes it. Danny is a transportation reporter with our news partners, the Baltimore Banner. Danny, thanks for coming on the show.
Absolutely, Matt. Thanks so much for having me on.
So back in March, many of us saw the story that the Baltimore Ravens had won a contest run by Elon Musk's company, The Boring Company, to dig a tunnel to their home in M&T Bank Stadium. But then the project was quietly dropped. And I was wondering, and I'm sure I'm not the only one, only you found out what happened. So what drove you to look into this?
Sure. Well, as you mentioned, you know, it was announced somewhat suddenly that a project called Ravens Loop in Baltimore was one of the winners of this contest. And I feel like myself and so many others were like, excuse me, what is Ravens Loop? And it took about a day until somebody from the Baltimore Ravens came out with a statement essentially saying, we were happy to be selected, but you know, after speaking with some public partners, we're not going to move forward with this. So before anybody really had any idea what this even was, we were learning about it, then learning that it wasn't going to happen. So sort of the natural next question was, well, what was it? What was the proposal? But nobody would say. And so that just kind of stuck with me. And I decided to file a series of public records requests under Maryland's Public Information Act to some of those public partners that the Ravens mentioned, just to see what information could have been shared. And after a couple of months, the documents that came back from that request showed us the proposal for what they had submitted to the contest.
And everyone would go read this article at the Banner, because this is the first time many of us really did find out, as you said, what this project was going to be like. And it was pretty fascinating, some of the things you found. That starts with what the project would have looked like. What was it going to be?
Sure. So Ravens Loop was a tunnel from M&T Bank Stadium to Harbor East, sort of moving up from the stadium to have a stop at Camden Yards, then next going to Harbor Place, the Inner Harbor, and then over to the Convention Center, then to the Inner Harbor, and then to Harbor East. So a sort of point-to-point loop system tunnel with five stops on it to sort of kind of connect the east and west sides of the main sort of Inner Harbor area. It's unclear if this was pitched as a pedestrian tunnel, so sort of like a underground walkway, or if it was going to be something like we see in Las Vegas with their loop system. For those that are unfamiliar, the loop in Las Vegas is this essentially series of kind of underground roads that that Teslas are driving through to take people to different attractions in Las Vegas around the start at their convention center, and then has expanded from there to go to other sort of attractions within the city. So to be clear, not a road that like anybody could drive their car into, but rather a one that sort of functions like a subway, like it has stations or stops, if you will, but instead of, you know, a train car, it would be a bunch of Teslas essentially providing like an Uber type service or something like that to go from point to point. So it's unclear if which of those was sort of on the docket here for Ravens Loop, but that's what they were looking for, was a way to sort of help the flow of traffic and the movement of people, not just on game days, but also it was pitched as sort of a win for the city and for commuters and people trying to get around the downtown area.
So you filed those FOIA requests, as you said. You got a lot of emails back and a lot of documents. What did these emails tell you about not just what this project would have been, but why did it get stopped?
Sure. Well, one of the most interesting things I found in some of these email exchanges. So what I got back were exchanges between certain city and state officials or members of sort of city agencies, state agencies, and members of the Baltimore Ravens organization. And what was interesting to me was to see what appeared to be one of the first times the Baltimore Ravens actually really engaged the mayor's office on this project. They sent an email in March of this year saying that they wanted to flag a contest for them that they had entered, which, you know, I sent messages after this to both the mayor's office and to the Ravens to sort of clarify these emails, because it sort of reads like it's the first instance that they had notified them of this project. And I wanted to ask, you know, when did you first tell the city about this major infrastructure project that you applied for? And I did not get a response to that, like a sort of straight up black and white response as to when we first engaged. But that really struck out, or that really stuck out to me that it seems that they didn't necessarily even tell the city about this until they were very far along in the contest here. And it was only a matter of days after that when they were named a winner. So we saw that message. We could see that there was an online meeting that was organized amongst members of the Raven staff and members of city and state agencies. And, you know, after that meeting is when it appears, you know, the public statements came out saying we're going to not move forward with this project. But sort of the definitive reason of why they're pulling out, that's still a bit of a mystery.
But certainly some things pointing to what you were reporting says there's that the city was not a part of this, city government at least, where the project would have been built. The city and the state of Maryland certainly have contentious relationships with a lot of transportation projects, including mass transportation, and that includes the Red Line, which we're going to be talking about in our next segment. But Elon Musk, typically as a businessman, likes to do things quickly. Shock the system is kind of one of his business philosophies. Do you think that's also a reason why this may not have worked?
Yeah, it's a good question. And I think, you know, like big infrastructure traditionally takes a really long time, right? And the system that we have in place for doing things, you know, you have to have major projects in a plan pipeline with several different regulatory agencies. And then there's planning and engineering, and things take years and years and years. And I think there's something to be said with how frustrating that can be, especially for residents who are just like, listen, I just want an easier way to get around town. Why does it take so long? And there's sort of something to be said about the benefits, right, of shocking the system or trying to find ways to deliver results for people quicker. And at the same time, you know, we have a process for a reason. We, especially when it comes to major infrastructure, there's plenty of examples around the country, even some here in Baltimore, of things that moved quickly. And, you know, as a result, years down the line, some of the issues start to come home to roost for, you know, that could have potentially been mitigated or avoided if we had sort of stopped and taken the time to really think things through. So it's a tough answer, but there has to be some sort of middle ground, I guess, between wanting to sort of push things forward and gain momentum and take opportunities when they're here. And at the same time, you have to build smart. You have to make sure you're not, harming the environment that you're going to build on, that, you know, the water table and the soil and all this stuff can actually support these things. And there's important processes to go through for that. So could it be a factor that they sort of didn't go through the right processes here? Certainly. Could it be just that, hey, you caught us off guard, we don't like that, so we're shutting this down? Possibly. Perhaps we'll never know, but it was certainly a very interesting proposal for what it was.
And another possibility of why it was abruptly stopped is that this was sponsored by the world's richest man, who the city of Baltimore was suing at the time for deep fake sexual images his AI Grok was putting out. To put it, mildly, Musk is a very divisive person, not particularly well liked by a very significant number of people. Did that have anything to do with this, from what you saw in these documents and emails?
Sure. It's a good question. There wasn't anything in the emails that we got back. There wasn't anything in the documents to suggest that that could have been a factor. I mean, you bring up a good point that he is certainly has become a very divisive figure across the country, across the world, most recently perhaps for that lawsuit you mentioned, and also for his work in DOGE, the so-called Department of Government Efficiency. And is it possible that the city and the state, you know, didn't want to be involved with anything that has his name anywhere near it? It's possible. But for what we could see within the documents in writing, that wasn't there.
And just very briefly, was this project ever going to come up again, or is Raven's Loop forever closed?
Much like when the Ravens' playoff chances were where the door was shut by another Ravens loop last year yes. when Tyler Loop missed wide right. I apologize to all the Ravens fans out there for bringing up that trauma once again. But much like that one, I think this Ravens loop is probably a done deal. So I wouldn't get your hopes up for, you know, traversing any underground LED light filled colorful Tesla tunnels anytime soon in under Baltimore, at least.
Danny Zawadny is the transportation reporter with our news partners at the Baltimore Banner. Check out the story that came out this week that he did on Ravens Loop. It is an absolutely fascinating piece of local journalism and exceptionally well done. Danny, thanks for coming on the show.
Hey, appreciate it. Thanks so much for having me.
Coming up, some of you have been getting surveys from the city asking for your thoughts on the future of the Red Line, another Baltimore transportation project with a long and painful history for many. That's been documented in a new film. Then we talked to the media reporter for Semaphore about a letter they got a hold of, pointing at more tension between Maryland's governor and the Baltimore Sun. And if that's not enough theater, we head out on a summer road trip to the Contemporary American Theater Festival, or CAFT, in Shepherdstown, West Virginia. This is WIPR's News Roundup. I'm Matt Bush. Stay with us.
Hi there. I'm David Ballou, the Director of Development at Baltimore Public Media. The summer brings the heat and everything with it. But it also reminds us at WIPR that our listeners continue to support local stories, art, and journalism. Thank you to everyone who donated before our fiscal year ended in June. It's your dedication to fact-based journalism that allows us to thrive this summer. As we enter the second half of the summer, I hope you continue to stay curious and inspired when tuning into WIPR. Thank you for being a part of the history of local public radio in Maryland. It's never too late to become a member of the WIPR family. You can make a gift easily now by visiting WIPR.org.
Baltimore Public Media's new Next Film Festival welcomes Oscar-nominated filmmaker Deborah Granick of Winter's Bone and Leave No Trace to the Charles Theater for a special screening of episodes of her new documentary series, Con Body vs. Everybody, on Wednesday, July 15th. She'll be joined by WIPR's Erica Kane for a conversation about the nonfiction series' insights to building community and breaking the cycle of recidivism. Tickets and more info at WIPR.org.
This week on the New Yorker Radio Hour, I'll talk with Rahm Emanuel about Israel and the United States and the best chance for peace in the Middle East. That's next time on the New Yorker Radio Hour.
Don't miss the New Yorker Radio Hour. Sunday morning at 10 here on WIPR, Baltimore's NPR news station.
And welcome back to WIPR's News Roundup. I'm Matt Bush, News Director of the award-winning WIPR Newsroom. We're talking about transportation this week. There's a new film on one of Baltimore City's most notorious transportation projects, The Red Line. Not in Service is the name. David Sebastio is the filmmaker, and he traces the history of the project to the very complicated history of the city and the state.
Nowhere ever have I experienced the vicious, ignorant, and racist hatred of public transit that I have observed here. It is a very particular phenomenon, unique in its intensity and depravity to Baltimore City. The story of transit in Baltimore City is a story of racism.
The film is screening later this month at the Central Branch of Enoch Pratt Library, July 25th. If you miss it, there will be more screenings. It's going to tell us an awful lot about the city, even just from that little clip you can tell. It really gets to the heart of a lot of things here in Baltimore. To tell us more about the film and the history of The Red Line, we have David Sebastio. He's here with us in studio. Thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you, Matt, for having me.
So let's start just with what's going on today. The Red Line project is still in the works. It was canceled, but the new governor, Wes Moore, brought it back, part of what he campaigned on. Just to be briefly, where does it stand right now?
Well, right now it's, you know, it is being planned again. The MTA has a whole bunch of folks working on it. They've gone through a lot of public meetings and processes, but unfortunately, as it stands right now, it's still very much a question of if it'll get built and what format it will get built in.
And that's a lot of the surveys that are a lot of people around the city who are nearby are getting. Do they want it to be a rail or a bus? Now, your film, though, is going to go back into the history of this, and it's a fascinating history, a deep dive that stretches beyond the strict boundaries of the Red Line Project, delves into the history of transportation itself here in Baltimore. You start the film talking about the plans for Highway 70, or what is known to here as many here as the Highway to Nowhere. We'll play that clip right now.
In the late 1960s, Baltimore City leaders planned for an extension of Interstate I-70. The project called for the demolition of more than 1,000 homes and businesses and ultimately displaced over 1,500 residents. The full highway plan later received resistance from other neighborhoods, and the project was ultimately scrapped in the early 70s. 40 years later, planning was underway for a new mass transit line, dubbed the Red Line.
So why did you start back looking at the Highway to Nowhere when it comes to the Red Line?
Right, and thank you for playing that clip and the beautiful narrator that I had there. She did a great job.
She did?
I wanted to start with that because it's a fascinating kind of duality there, where you had this terrible project in the 70s that destroyed that section of Baltimore and put the Highway to Nowhere there. But then you had the opportunity some 40, 50 years later to repurpose that as a conduit for that Red Line track that would have a few stops there as well. I believe serving like the Harlem Park neighborhood, which is one of the neighborhoods that was displaced there. So it was kind of that interesting duality there. Unfortunately, that project has no good use. You thought maybe there can be some redeeming quality to this, but unfortunately, no.
So the Red Line is a mass transit, or would be a mass transit line that would go run east to west in the city, unlike some of the other ones that go north and south. The story of that comes with a decision made by Maryland's former governor, Larry Hogan, right after he took office in 2015 to scrap the project. That's despite the fact the state had already secured the necessary federal funds under his Democratic predecessor, Martin O'Malley. Just to go back for that, explain how that happened.
Can you repeat that question
How was the decision that the Governor Hogan made at the time in 2015? How did he kind of arrive to that, and how much of it was a shock to people because the funds had already been secured?
Right, that's right. So $900 million was secured for that project from the federal government, and then there was a lot of hoops that they had to go through to get that money, and there was what is called a record of decision was given to the project as well, which was from the federal government telling the state of Maryland, you are allowed to start spending this money on this project. And that was all done before Larry Hogan decided to cancel the project. So it certainly was shocking to a lot of people because they thought, we've made it. We're about to start construction in just a few months. So unfortunately, Larry Hogan decided to cancel that because in his view, it was a waste of money. It was poorly designed, and that there was better projects to spend the state's money on, which in turn meant just completely erasing that federal money because that federal money could not be used for any other projects.
Right. It was sent back to the federal government. Stunning thing that happens. It doesn't often happen when states send back money once they get it from the federal government. Now, we played that clip at the beginning of this segment with Maryland Delegate Robin T. Lewis. She said, the story of transit in Baltimore is the story of racism. You spoke to black and white journalists, documentarians, activists, and lawmakers. What did you come away with? Is that what she said correct at the top of this?
I definitely believe it is correct because it's not the only factor, but a very strong contributing factor is people's attitude towards transit. And that is because of racist, feelings that people have. They don't want certain people coming to their neighborhoods. They don't want there's this perception of crime from, again, certain people. And there isn't really much data or fact to back any of those claims up. So at the end of the day, it is racism, unfortunately.
And just to also put a point on that, too, of at the same time, it was even in the same press conference that the governor gave in 2015. The Purple Line was going on at the same time. That's still not open in the D.C. suburbs, but those are much richer suburbs than this region. And the governor allowed that to go forward, though, in a different way. It's now a PPP. But is that any surprise, too, as you looked into this, that the Purple Line was allowed to go forward, but it was the Red Line that was sacrificed?
Yeah, exactly. That's certainly one of the one of the toughest pills to swallow for this whole charade is that, yes, the Purple Line was allowed to go forward. And a lot of that is because of, yeah, who it serves. It's, you know, it goes through some white neighborhoods. It serves this D.C. area, which the D.C. area brings in a lot of money for the state of Maryland. So it just had kind of better foundation in that way for just like the people that were, there was a lot more political will for the people that wanted it to get built. So unfortunately, yeah, that's the way it worked out.
As you look at it now, where the Red Line stands, and you just finished this documentary, which again, you can catch the premiere of it at the Enoch Pratt Central Library on Saturday, July 25th at 1:30. What would success look like in the end for the Red Line?
Right. Well, that is a really good question, because, you know, it could be that it still gets built, but it might be a toned down version, like bus rapid transit or something. That kind of seems to be the trend. Or it could be that we just have to wait even longer for an actual rail project. I don't know if, to a lot of people, a bus rapid transit system is a success, because it's very far from what the original vision was. But to others, it is. So it kind of depends on who you ask. And ultimately, that goes to the people that are going to be using it. And if it's something at the end of the day that really helps people improve their commute about where they're going to, then sure, that is successful. But at the same time, it's certainly not what it could have been.
David Sebastio is the creator of Not in Service, a documentary that looks at Baltimore's Red Line. You can catch it at the Enoch Pratt Central Library on Saturday, July 25th at 1:30. Something to keep you out of the heat. There's going to be plenty of additional screenings as well. Check out the website, silentmediagroup.com. David, thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you, Matt.
Up next, we hear more about an ongoing rift between the current Governor Wes Moore and the owner of the Baltimore Sun. A reporter at Semaphore got a hold of the document with details on that. This is WYPR's News Roundup. Stay with us.
As the dog days of summer settle over Charm City, shake them off at WTMD's next First Thursday concert. With the cool rhythm and blues of Sun Little, acoustic folk pop by New York's Late Night Thoughts, and Rise Above It All with Baltimore's Icarus Phoenix. Find all you need in the Vendor Village. Local food, drink, even art. Maryland's best outdoor concert experience is free. WTMD's First Thursday, August 6th in Canton Waterfront Park. Details at WTMD.org.
Practical Parenting, a podcast produced by GBMC, helps empower parents in the trenches and find joy in the magical mess of summer. The sun is out and so are the schedules. But don't worry, we have your back. New episodes drop every other Friday. Tune in to get all the resources, support, and confidence you need to thrive through the chaos. Practical Parenting, available on WYPR.org, the mobile app, and wherever you get your podcasts.
ICE has ordered their field offices to send out more officers every single day to ramp up operations. What that means is you're going to see more of these confrontations to get that number of 2,000 arrests a day.
I'm Rachel Abrams. That's Today on the Daily from the New York Times.
Don't miss the Daily right after Marketplace, which begins at 6 here on WIPR, Baltimore's NPR news station at 88.1.
And welcome back to WYPR's News Roundup. I'm Matt Bush. We have another document discovery shedding light on a disagreement of local leaders that has faded from the public eye until this week. There's been increasing tensions between David Smith, owner of conservative Sinclair Media, whose outlets include the Baltimore Sun and Fox 45 TV, and Maryland Governor Wes Moore. It touched on Moore's military record, and last month, Moore took a jab at Smith, saying he was, quote, invested in by Jeffrey Epstein, the financier. That resulted in a letter that found its way to the desk of Semaphore's Max Tawney, who's on the line with us now to talk about what happened and what he's learned. Max, thanks for coming on the show.
Thanks for having me.
Give us the backstory on this very quickly for maybe some who have not been following along with the Sun and Fox 45's coverage, and what the documents were that you came across, and how did you come across them?
Yeah, absolutely. There are a lot of twists and turns here. So, you know, people can bear with me. I will try to be brief. Over the last several months, the Baltimore, in a collaboration between the Baltimore Sun and Fox 45, you know, and its parent company, Sinclair, there's been this investigative group called Spotlight on Maryland, which has been looking into claims made by Governor Wes Moore about his military service record. That's really upset the governor and many on his staff who have been very critical in saying that essentially this investigation, the series of investigations, is a political hit job. During an interview on MSNBC in June, Wes Moore made a suggestion that Jeffrey Epstein had some sort of ties with David Smith, pointing to investments that some of Epstein's funds had made in Sinclair when Smith was the chairman. This really upset Sinclair and upset Smith, who in his personal capacity sent a legal letter to Governor Wes Moore, basically asking for a document preservation and saying that his comments making ties between him and Epstein were potentially defamatory.
So you reached out to Moore's team to get their reaction to this potential lawsuit, or the threat of it at the very least, and it sounds like they're defending the statement. What basis was the governor making this claim?
Yeah, Moore's team essentially has been pointing to public documents released by the Department of Justice as part of their ongoing release of all of these documents from the quote unquote Epstein files. And in these documents, it showed investments that Epstein's funds had made in Sinclair when Smith was the chairman. One interesting note, and this wasn't in my story, but I think it's worth pointing out, is in his legal letter to Moore, his initial legal letter, Smith, one of the lines that Smith's attorney had was basically present some evidence here. Tell us what you're talking about. And so this letter that I obtained this week from Moore's camp in response to that basically points to these documents and says this is what I was saying when I suggested some sort of link between Epstein and Smith.
And when would these investments taken place?
There were two different investments that Moore's team pointed to these were years and years ago. I believe one of them was in like 2012 or 2013. And then there was another investment by another fund that Epstein had been involved in. So these were two separate instances totaling out to around, $300,000, which, could be a lot of money depending on how you look at it. Epstein obviously was a billionaire, but there were two separate investments that Moore's team pointed to in their letter, in their response to Smith.
Now, this reporting's taking place, this stuff that's coming from Fox 45 and The Sun, in an election year, and this leak to you also happened in an election year when the governor is running for a second term, much less what might be coming in 2 years. How much did you think that may have played a role in what you have seen?
Yeah, I think that it's impossible to not look at this through the frame of 2028 and Moore's potential, likely, possible interest in running for president. However you want to frame it, he'll be in. As an aside, I believe he'll be in South Carolina in the coming days, right, as well, which, as we know, is one of the early primary states. I think this is my personal view, but I think it's shared by a lot of people who've been following the story very closely. That the interest by Spotlight on Maryland, by Dave Smith, by these reporters at Sinclair, and in these published reports in the Baltimore Sun, it's hard not to look at it through the lens of 2028, in particular because of just how much attention to detail these reporters are invested in. Essentially, they are really combing through, and like investigators combing through every previous statement that he's ever made, in a way that campaign opposition researchers might comb through previous statements of a potential candidate who they're running against.
And another thing you said at your Semaphore article, you finish it by saying the open battle between The Sun and Moore is also the latest sign of increasing tensions between parts of the Democratic Party and legacy media. Explain what you mean by that, because you also went on then to talk about New York Mayor Zohran Mamdani not going on The View.
Yeah. One thing that I have noticed, and I think this is a real shift in over the past several years, maybe in particular since Joe Biden dropped out of the race and was replaced by Kamala Harris, is there is this kind of rising tide of either disillusionment, cynicism, or skepticism by a notable part of the Democratic primary base and among some lawmakers and leaders in the Democratic Party when it comes to legacy media. We've seen a lot of this in criticism that many Democrats have had about the Ellisons and their takeover of CBS News. And we've just seen it in the ways that some Democratic leaders will push back against some legacy media outlets. The Zoran Mamdani example I was referring to was about a few articles I wrote regarding a member of his outside political team complaining to The View about comments that they had made around one of his close political allies in New York, one of the new Democratic primary candidates for Congress there, in a private telephone call that I described in my story. Essentially, this advisor to Zoran said, you know, if you continue covering one of Zoran's allies this way, you know, we might not let, you know, have Zoran go back on The View when you ask for him. So I just think that there's a bit of a shift happening in terms of Democrats' attitudes when it comes to the mainstream media.
Max Tawney is with Semaphore. Some fantastic reporting about this back and forth between the governor and Sinclair Media here in Maryland. Max, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thanks for having me.
Go read his stuff. Coming up next, actual theater and a road trip. Stay with us.
Support for WIPR comes from Freedom Car, celebrating 35 years of transporting Baltimore-area families, businesses, and organizations around the metro area and beyond. More information at freedomcar.net.
LGBTQ plus people have long been part of Maryland's story, but their histories have often gone untold. In the latest episode of Maryland Unfolded, Dr. Kalima Young speaks with Ben Eagerman about the state's LGBTQ plus past and his new book, A Gay Little History of Maryland. Maryland Unfolded is available on the first and third Thursdays of the month at WYPR.org or wherever you get your podcasts, and is made possible in part by Gallagher LLP.
Baltimore Public Media's New Next Film Festival welcomes Oscar-nominated filmmaker Deborah Granick of Winter's Bone and Leave No Trace to the Charles Theater for a special screening of episodes of her new documentary series, Conbody vs. Everybody, on Wednesday, July 15th. She'll be joined by WIPR's Erica Kane for a conversation about the nonfiction series' insights to building community and breaking the cycle of recidivism. Tickets and more info at WYPR.org.
Before the U.S.-Iran war, about one-fifth of the world's oil passed freely through the Strait of Hormuz. Now Iran controls the Strait. What precedent does that set for other waterways? That's on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Coming up this afternoon at 4 here on WIPR, Baltimore's NPR News Station at 88.1.
Ready or not, here I come.
This is WIPR's News Roundup.
Gonna find you.
And that, of course, is Ready or Not by the Fugees. Any Gen Xer would know that. For fans of them, the Ms. Lauryn Hill is performing a rare acoustic show this Sunday, July 19th at Pier 6 in Baltimore. The show starts at 7. Doors open at 5. Additionally, the Walters Museum is holding a free block party on Saturday morning at 11. Comedian Stavros Fokaias is taping his new special for Netflix at the Lyric on Saturday and Sunday. For those of you who can get out of town and want to, you could go to the Contemporary American Theater Festival in Shepherdstown, West Virginia, which is celebrating its 36th season. Each year, they produce completely new plays for the public to see. This year, they have 5 fully staged new plays you can see right now. People from all over the country will be coming to it, but we're lucky to have it right in our own backyard. Joining us now is Peggy McCowan, Artistic Director for the festival. She's been with CATF for the last 20 years. Peggy, welcome to the show.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
Now, this year's season has 4 world premieres. Now, before we look ahead to those plays, can you tell us about the Contemporary American Theater Festival and how it got started?
Yes, we are a professional theater that, as you said, produces new work. And we are one of the last remaining theaters in the country that does fully produced plays and repertory. And we started in 1991 in a collaboration between the president of Shepherd University and the then theater consultant, Ed Herendeen, from the Williamstown Theater Festival, who then became the founder of CATF. And we've been here for 36 years.
Now, what can people expect from this festival? Maybe they hear that word and they think of tents and vendors, but that's not really what this is, right?
No, not at all. We actually have 3 lovely theaters that we work in on the campus of Shepherd University, and they are all within walking distance of each other. So they're lovely facilities. And you can see all five plays in 2.5 days. And you can see a play in the afternoon in one theater. We change over and you can see another play in the evening. And we have events around that that give that festival atmosphere. But we are in three lovely theaters and a physical plant here.
And we have a clip from playwright Yusuf Elgendi's Refugee Rhapsody. He's an Arab-American playwright known for his plays merging the personal and political and interrogating questions of Arab-American identity post 9/11. Let's give that a listen.
Are you married?
Yes, happily.
We have our moments like any couple.
Are you still attracted to him?
Sakina.
At least tell me his name if we're sharing personal stuff.
Richard, I'd rather we focus on you.
Right. I'm the center of attention. I'm here because I'm supposed to have reacted to not feeling like the center of their attention. But it's not true.
How do you mean?
This isn't about love. We're not just. People get very sanctimonious talking about other people's addictions. Every year, we set aside a day to celebrate something that can devastate you just as much.
That was Elena Eshraghi playing Sakina and Jada Alston Owens as Jenny. Can you tell us about this play and the other plays that attendees are going to be able to see?
Yes. Refugee Rhapsody is the story of an immigrant and a refugee who have bonded and developed a relationship as they have come to this country. And at the point that we meet them, they have also just met a philanthropist who is an advocate for immigration and refugees. The play unfolds in a way that they become friends, and then the play takes a turn and we learn that there has been a crime committed, and we follow the journey of what happens there. And it is a dark comedy because there's a great deal of humor until, of course, the play changes and turns to something a little more dark. And then the play also has an interesting narrative about how we perceive each other and how people frame certain narratives. So that's Refugee Rhapsody. The other plays are The Smoker by Lisa Damore, and that is a play that is about folks who stand outside their building in the Bronx, New York, smoking, and the community and the bonds that they build around that. So it's a very slice of life play. But it also is elevated with this great poetry, and there's some opera because one of the tenants is an opera singer, and it moves from a very linear structure to this more poetic narrative. And then we have Best Line Wins, The Improvised Lives of Elaine May and Mike Nichols. And that is a story about their relationship, how they started in Chicago, moving to New York on Broadway, moving into Hollywood, and particularly about Elaine's journey as a woman in the 50s and 60s and beyond, carving a career in a very difficult industry for women in Hollywood, and the work that she did as a director, a screenwriter, an actress, and the sort of legacy that she left for women to follow her. And then we have Vos, which is a second production, and that is the story of two women who are on a journey to, one of which is trying to become pregnant, and her fertility journey, and she ends up being in Argentina and becomes acquainted with the history of Argentina.
We have to stop it there for you, for everyone. Peggy, thank you so much for coming on the show. You can find more information about the Contemporary American Theater Festival at catf.org. It runs until August 2nd. And that does it for this week's WIPR News Roundup. I'm Matt Bush, the news director here at WIPR. Isaac Moss, Elizabeth Nonemaker, and Mallory Pinkard-Pierre helped us with production today. Shania Mapson and Sean Murphy are our studio engineers, and Amy Walters is WIPR's executive producer. Thank you for listening.
Think about what you hear when you tune to WIPR. We cover the arts, local government, the environment, health, education, sports, culture, history, books, food, and wine. And that's just our own locally produced programs. I'm Lisa Morgan. Join me and others just like you who value WIPR and all the news and information we bring you every day. From around the world with NPR and the BBC, and around Maryland with our local team of dedicated... Your support makes it all possible. We simply couldn't do it without you. Become a member now at WIPR.org, and thanks.
Morning Edition brings you the news straight from reporters watching stories unfold.
To talk about that, we're joined by NPR's international correspondent Aya Batraoui in Dubai. Good morning.
Moz Bashel from member station KUT gives us a view from Austin, Texas.
NPR's Ada Peralta is with us now from Venezuela's capital, Caracas. Ada, good morning.
Join us for a front row seat every weekday on Morning Edition from NPR News.
And beginning at 5 a.m. Monday through Friday here on WIPR, Baltimore's NPR News Station, where we are community amplified. We are Baltimore Public Media, 88.1 WIPR, and WIPR HD1 Baltimore, WIPR Frederick,